Welcome to all of you to the 2011 CAPTS Lecture in Christian Thought. I'm turning off my cell phone right now, even as we speak, so maybe you could join me in that ritual. My name is Charles Marsh, and I'm a professor of religious studies here at the university and director of the Project on Lived Theology. I am delighted to see all of you out on this beautiful spring evening, and look forward to our time together in the next hour and a half. The CAPTS lectures are a public lecture series made possible by the generosity of Dr. W. Jerry Capps and Mrs. Capps, Catherine Capps of Atlanta, Georgia. The purpose of the series is to bring to Central Grounds preeminent theologians to address social and political issues with the resources of the Christian tradition. We are grateful to the Capps family for their patronage and delighted that they were able to join us this afternoon from Atlanta. This year's lecturer, Emmanuel Cantagalle, epitomizes the vision and purposes of these lectures, and I welcome you, dear friend, to Charlottesville. Born in the village of Malabe, Uganda, Emmanuel was ordained as a Roman Catholic priest by the Kampala Archdiocese in 1987 and has since his ordination served parishes in Africa, Belgium, and the United States. Currently serving as a professor of theology and world Christianity at Duke Divinity School and co-founder of the remarkable Center on Reconciliation at Duke, Professor Cantagalle's academic credentials are well established, with the degrees from Makerere University in Uganda, from the Pontifical University in Rome, and the Catholic University of Leuven. His teaching and research interests cover a wide range of issues related to theology and violence, especially in Africa. Of special significance is his interest in the role of stories and social memory and the formation of political identity and the nature and role of Christian imagination in shaping possibilities for justice and reconciliation. His numerous published works include African Theology Today, A Future of Africa, and most recently, the book, The Sacrifice of Africa, A Political Theology for Africa, which I highly commend to you, and which is on sale at Splintered Light Bookstore, just stone's throw away on the corner. In all of these capacities, teaching, writing, and service, Professor Cantagalle has committed himself to thinking hard and thinking well and thinking courageously about a cluster of topics related to this evening's lecture. Indeed, to my mind, his topic this evening is as bold as it is important: daring to invent the future of Africa, on modernity, politics, and the madness of Christian faith. So it is with great pleasure and anticipation that I present to you Professor Emmanuel Cantagalle.
Thank you, my friend Charles, for inviting me and welcoming me here. Thank you, Karen. I'm indeed very much honored to be here this afternoon. And thank you, Dr. Capps and Mrs. Capps, for endowing this lecture series and for making it possible for me to be here this afternoon. I stand here in fear and trembling because I realize that I am very far from the village of Malube. I was actually joking with Karen, but kind of half seriously joking, that I was going to write home or call home and tell them that you will not believe it, but I am sleeping tonight in the Thomas Jefferson bedroom and in his bed. So this, for me, is such an incredible opportunity to be here this afternoon, but also to be here this afternoon to speak about a topic that is so dear to my heart, about Africa. And the question that usually many people have on their minds, many are not bold enough to raise it openly, but a question that many people have is there any hope in Africa? Is there any hope for Africa? That's the topic I want to speak about and engage you in conversation with this evening about modernity, African politics, and the madness of Christian faith on daring to invent the future of Africa. You know, every time I get Time magazine, one of the pages I turn to is the word briefing section of Time magazine. And one reason that I do turn to the word briefing section is that because it kind of captures what, according to Time magazine, might be the prominent news going on within that 1 week around the world. And the Time magazine word briefing of March 14 had two news items on Africa. The first news item was a power struggle pushes the country toward civil war. It described an interminable political deadlock that teetered toward outright civil war in Côte d'Ivoire, or Ivory Coast, as gun battles raged between troops loyal to incumbent President Laurent Gbagbo and the supporters of his opponent Alassane Ouattara. According to the UN, Ouattara was the winner of the November presidential election, but Gbagbo, who has ruled Ivory Coast for almost a decade, refused to recognize the results, an act that plunged the country into crisis. That was the first brief. Power struggle pushes the country toward civil war. The second item was on Guinea. 300 million Equatorial Guinea, and described, that is the price of a yacht reportedly ordered by the son of the country's dictator, Teodoro Obianga, who has been in power for 30 years. It is almost three times what Guinea spends on education and health. These two news briefs capture, help to frame our discussion tonight. You know, there was a time when an African like myself would quickly dismiss such a news reports as the biased reporting of Western media that is only interested when it comes to Africa, on reporting only bad news. We would happily point to other more positive developments in Africa that never make the news in the West. I must admit that even as the bias of the Western media in reporting on Africa is granted, news reports like these have become so commonplace that they require serious critical attention, especially since they reflect what has come to be expected in relation to politics in Africa. Dictatorship, outlandish corruption, and elections that do not deliver any democratic transition, but result into deadlock, endless power struggles, and civil war. You know, even these kind of news briefs do not capture the whole extent of the social and human tragedy that is going on in Africa. Just imagine that the civil war in Eastern Congo in the last 15 years has killed over 5.4 million people. 5.4 million people. And has left over 2 million people displaced. That the civil war in northern Uganda that lasted over 23 years left over 300,000 people dead abducted over 26,000 children and left millions of the population displaced. The Ugandan news reports usually very casually refers to that civil war as the insurgency in northern Uganda. 1994, Rwanda, close to 1 million people killed within a span of 100 days. A series of ethnic attacks and reprisals have left this beautiful country of Burundi haunted and fixed in a culture of fear and war, and reduced this beautiful country to one of the poorest in Africa. The UN estimates that about 120,000 children in Africa, some as young as 7, are participating in armed conflicts. The UN Economic Commission for Africa indicated that four weeks ago that poverty levels in Africa had increased by 43% over the last 10 years, with women making up over 80%. Perhaps we have grown even accustomed to these statistics, that they do not even speak to us, that they do not even, we don't even feel anymore the power of these statistics. And yet these numbers just tell part of the story. As a scholar, I am very, very much disheartened, not only by these statistics, but even more disheartening for me is the fact that even in the face of such a reports, endless reports, there is still, by large, a lack, and in some cases, even a resistance to a critical engagement of Africa's social history, which could illumine why this type of negative excellence has become an integral part of Africa. So that today, when we speak and think about Africa, we think and speak about poverty, war, corruption, and dictatorship. What is going on? Where is hope, or is there hope in Africa? You know, it is not that we in Africa, or it's not that the West has not neglected Africa. It's not that the West has not attended to the plight that is going on in Africa. No. In the midst of Africa's crisis, social and human crisis, there have been numerous attempts, and that might be part of the problem, there have been numerous attempts to come to the rescue of Africa, to save or ameliorate the situation in Africa, the human and social crisis. There have been numerous attempts, but to the extent that most of these attempts are grounded on shallow analysis of what Africa's underlying problem is, they are the wrong type of solutions. To put the argument very briefly, the argument of this evening is that most of the attempts to come to the rescue of Africa, to save Africa, to help Africa, most of the attempts assume that the primary challenge facing Africa is one of realizing and living into the full social, economic, and political dispensation of modernity. That if we are able to live within that, within its legal, transparent, and democratic dispensation, then there will be mechanisms and peace in Africa that will ensure a culture of respect for human rights and development. My argument is that it's not that modernity and the modern institutions have not worked in Africa. In a way, the modern institutions of politics and economics have worked in Africa and worked very well. The problem, rather, has been the story within which these institutions are framed, are grounded. What is needed is not so much mechanisms to fix
to help to prop up modern state institutions, economics, and politics. What is needed? It's not so much these mechanisms. What is needed is a different story to reframe these institutions within Africa. Let me explain. Most attempts to save the situation in Africa, and there have been so many wide-ranging attempts, ranging from humanitarian intervention of aid to development assistance of various kinds, including policy recommendations, legal and technical solutions, strategies to advance democratization and political accountability. A lot of recommendations in Africa. And these recommendations have become more intensified in the recent past. So intensified that if you visit an African university, you will most likely find at any African university either a center for civil governance, a center for democratic development, conflict mediation, human rights, ethics and development, and peace building. Almost each and every university in Africa has one or two of such centers. Social ethics in Africa is such a vibrant, lively, and I even say lucrative business in many African universities. So that often armed with the latest theories from the social sciences and up-to-date training materials, these different centers, in a way, equip civil servants, politicians, with the latest techniques of how to help democracy work. And I have done a survey. At any given weekend, traveling around Kampala, it's amazing from one hotel to the other, whether it is the Sheraton Hotel, the Speak Hotel, and so on. It's amazing to see the number of seminars going on, whether they are seminars for justice mechanisms or seminars for peace building, seminars for food security, accountability, peer evaluation, anti-corruption training. It's amazing to see the number of seminars going on at any given weekend in any hotel in an African country. Now, these seminars, of course, equip the participants with the latest skills and mechanisms and kind of unleash them into society with the hope that they will, with now equipped with the skills and mechanisms, they will be able to advance a democratic culture, economic empowerment, the rule of law, the respect for human rights. The hope is that with such a training, with such a expertise, with such a mechanisms and controls, African institutions will begin to work more or less in the same democratic, legal, transparent, and efficient way as they do in the West and more increasingly in Asia. The assumption is that these institutions have not done so, have not operated so well in Africa because of a number of bottlenecks and problems and factors, and some of these factors are grounded in Africa's cultural past, and some of the factors are grounded in international systems and neocolonial controls. Some is because of the debt burdens that Africa is facing. Others is because Africa's weak institutions. And so that's where social ethics now comes in, to prop up these weak political and economic institutions in Africa through ethical, legal, structural, and policy adjustments. That is the primary role that social ethics does in Africa. And Christian ethics itself is drawn very easily, quickly into this as also another way to prop up these institutions so that what we call Christian social responsibility in general is often nothing but the Christian version of this prescriptive attempt to save nation state and economic modalities in Africa. You know, the assumption that the ongoing realities of civil war, of violence, of corruption and poverty and tribalism in Africa just reflect a weak or failed institutions in Africa is misleading. In fact, is wrong. Violence in Africa, chaos, tribalism, corruption, all this do not reflect a failing or a weak political, economic institutions and culture in Africa. They are part and parcel of the contradictions that constitute the unique modernity of Africa. These aspects of corruption, of violence, of war, they are part of that unique modernity of Africa. And if you think about it from that point of view, then modernity has worked in Africa and has worked very well. If you think of Africa as a house that keeps getting broken into, a house that keeps falling down, a house that whose roof keeps leaking, the furniture gets broken now and again, we can be so much engaged in fixing this house, in putting new bagra proof on the house, in putting a new roof, in repainting the house, in arranging the furniture in the house, when the real issue of Africa is the very foundation on which that house has been constructed. And that foundation has so much to do with the underlying story that grounds, that frames modernity in Africa. The underlying story. Much of what I want to say this evening has to do with the underlying story within which Africa was grafted, was received, was in a way connected into the stream that we call modernity. But I don't want to take so much time explaining that kind of foundation, but it has to do really with recognizing that imagination and story play a key role in the formation of communities. In fact, all communities are imagined communities, and that imagination happens through stories, stories that ground the very foundation of those communities. You see, in Africa, it went like this. Africa's initial contact with modernity had to do with the very historical event of European colonialism in Africa. It has to do with the event of Europe's contact with Africa. Within that project and contact, and the social anthropology that sustained the whole of that project, African societies and cultures had nothing to contribute to civilization. African peoples had nothing to contribute to that purported civilizing project that Europe had come to effect in Africa. For within the social imagination of European contact in Africa, Africa was imagined, thought about, was viewed and treated as savage, as backward, as a dark continent, and its land as no man's land, whose riches were open to expropriation, call it development, by the modernizing powers of Europe. This is how Africa came to be received into modernity. Basically through a narrative that rejected Africa, nothing good out of Africa, through a politics of control and domination, and through an economics of plunder and expropriation of Africa's abundant resources. Now, the modern institutions, education, economics, and politics that were established during this colonial time not only assumed this imagination, they legitimated it, they protected it, and reproduced it, especially through the education institutions, especially through the elite, that we are the beneficiaries of that education. Now, with the rise of independence, European nations, of course, were forced to give up their colonies and all power to the Africans. What, of course, is now very clear is that the African elite that took over from the colonialists and now became the dominant actors in a post-colonial Africa have continued to operate within the very same idea and imagination of an Africa as a savage, as a dark continent, as no man's land that is open to exploitation and plunder, and whose people, the peasants, the village people, have nothing to contribute to the project that we call modernity. In other words, these successor institutions, nation state, economic bureaucracies, and others, even though now locally manned, they continue to operate out of the same script, out of the same framework that rejects, exploits, and plunders Africa, while at the same time purportedly civilizing Africa, modernizing Africa. So African presidents are always talking about the modernization project. We are modernizing Africa. We are saving Africans from tribalism and so forth. And of course, in the process of doing so, reproduce the very same factors that give them a reason for staying in power. This is perhaps best exemplified in the case of the Congo. When you think about, for example, the Congo, 5.4 million people killed in the last 15 years by Congolese, Hema and Lendu fighting, and by Africans, Rwanda and Congo fighting, Rwanda and Uganda fighting in the Congo. When you think about it, you say, oh my goodness, what's going on? Look at all these Africans killing themselves. But let's step back in terms of the imagination, in terms of the idea, the Congo. Let's step back. And realize in terms of the performance, Mr. Coots in the Heart of Darkness, it's a very short line that connects Mr. Coots of the Heart of Darkness to King Leopold of Belgium, who owned the Congo. It's a very short line from King Leopold to Mobutu, who was in power for almost 30 years. It's a very short line from Mobutu to the Kabilas of the 1990s. It is a very short line from the Kabilas to Uganda and Rwanda now joining the plunder of the Congo. It's a very short line from the Rwandans and Ugandans joining to local militias now. And the story, it hasn't changed. It is the same story of plunder, of rape, of the Congo. The actors have changed. The actors keep on changing, but the story doesn't change. That is why the fighting in the Congo, even in its most barbaric and tribal representation, does not represent a failure of modernity in the Congo. It is a heightened form of modernity, the working out of particular imaginations and political and economic rationalities within Africa's social history. And you know, the same is true with much of what is often described as ethnic conflict in Africa, tribal violence, whether it is in Rwanda, whether it is in Kenya, whether it is in the Congo, Hema, and Len. It is misleading, very misleading, to characterize these developments, as they often are, as, oh, these are old animosities of the tribes that has been reignited. It is misleading. These are very modern developments. These represent, in a way, a very modern phenomena in which African associations, cultural associations now, get to be drawn, recruited, if you like, within the performance of a power struggle of a few limited elite in the politics of the belly, in the politics of eating. It is within this story, in a way, that you can begin to think Gabor and Obiang. This is a kind of story framework that makes Gabo and Biang and the Mugabes of this world thinkable. So, what are we to do now that we find ourselves within this narrative, that we find ourselves within this story? What is required if Africa is to move into a new future where the stories of people like Obiang and Gabo would become a shocking exception instead of the norm? What do we need? I suggest that we need to look into the very foundations, and that has connected with the imagination and the story, and that has to do with a reworking, revisioning, a rewiring, a reimagination of Africa. This is the project I call Daring to Invent the Future of Africa. I think it is this project of daring to invent the future of Africa that the late Burkina Faso president, Thomas Sankara, was getting to in his very brief years, 5 years as president. So perhaps let's take some time to talk about Thomas Sankara and what he represents in terms of this project, to see some of the requirements of daring to invent the future. I know Africa is huge, but if you can imagine in terms of the map of Africa, if you can imagine the belly of Africa on the western coast there, and you can see Ghana, the former Gold Coast, just on top of Ghana is this small country that used to be called Upper Volta. In 1983, a young general came to power through a military revolution in Upper Volta. His name was Thomas Sankara, and was 33 years when he came to power. Now, Upper Volta was, and in many ways still is, one of Africa's poorest countries. The infant mortality was one of the highest. There was one doctor for every 50,000 people. Average income, $150. And more than 7 million people lived in the countryside where there was endless drought and famine. Now, when he came to power, Thomas Sankara immediately understood that the problem of his country was not these natural factors of famine and drought, that it was really the key problem. He immediately saw that the problem of Upper Volta was the connection, the intimate connection between the post-colonial Upper Volta and its colonial heritage. So in his speech immediately after coming to power, he noted, "In essence, colonial society and neo-colonial society differed not at all. The colonial administration was replaced by a neo-colonial administration identical to it in every respect. The colonial army was replaced by a neo-colonial army with the same characteristics, the same functions, and the same role of safeguarding the interests of imperialism and its national allies. The colonial school system was replaced by neo-colonial schools, which pursued the same goals of alienating our children from the country and reproducing a society that would primarily serve the interests of imperialism and secondly those of its local allies." And beyond this connection, that's the end of quote, beyond this connection, Sankara was immediate to see that it is the same story of plunder, of exploitation, of serving elite interests that was going on in Upper Volta as when Upper Volta was under the French, as now independent Upper Volta. Because Sankara was very clear about the underlying story which shaped Upper Volta, he also clearly understood that reversing that story requires more than just making adjustments. And there were a lot of recommendations, suggestions. IMF was there, World Bank was there, and a lot of other technical experts from Europe and the US offering all different sorts of recommendations and suggestions and solutions of policies, of adjustments of what needed to be done. But Sankara understood that the project that was really required was not just implementing these structural adjustments. The problem required a complete overhaul, a revolution, as he called it, that would turn upper voter society upside down. A revolution, according to Thomas Sankara, that would recast upper voter within a new paradigm, that would, in a way, rethink upper voter in a new way, that would, instead of building a colonial elite society that depended and exploited the masses, that would, in a way, mobilize the masses toward their own liberative struggles. In other words, Sankara realized that what was needed was a foundation of a new society in upper Volta. Sankara realized that, but also he realized that doing so, providing that new foundation, required a lot of courage, because it required thinking outside the paradigm, thinking outside the parameters, and especially with all these other factors offering one solution after another of how to build a modern democratic upper Volta. He realized that these many recommendations and suggestions and offer of how to were in a way a distraction from the very task that was needed. So that's why Thomas Sankara said doing so requires a certain type of courage. He called it a daring to invent the future, but also constituted a form of madness. And so, and this is one of my most beautiful quotations from him. So in a speech he noted, "You cannot carry out fundamental change without a certain amount of madness. In this case, the madness comes from non-conformity, the ability to turn our back on old formulas, the courage to invent the future. It took madmen of yesterday for us to be able to act with extreme clarity today. I want to be one of those madmen. We must dare to invent the future. We must dare to invent the future." Now, this is the kind of madness that actually Thomas Sankara gave himself into for the 5 years he was president in order to dare to invent the future. And so part of this madness during this time, he carried out most extensive land reforms, agricultural and economic reforms. For example, the prices of the cash crops was doubled. The land was nationalized. The best care health services were extended to the countryside. A lot of total revolutionary reforms. Other reforms of Sankara's revolution, in a way, targeted, most of them actually did target women and the empowerment of women. For example, in his cabinet, he had a large number of women, which was new in Africa. He banned female genital mutilation. He condemned polygamy and promoted contraception. He declared the 22nd of September of every year a gender day, in which on that day, women sat at home and men did all the chores of women. They went to the market, they went to the forest to collect the firewood, they cooked, and then also got a sting of the smoke that was the dairy, in a way, the women experience every day. You know, some of these reforms, one can say, were in a way of a symbolic nature, but I think they were getting to what Sankara was about. And part of the symbolic reforms, for example, that when he was appointed the Minister of Education before he made the coup, he actually came to his first cabinet meeting on a bicycle. He came on a bicycle. And when he was president, the first thing he did was to sell all the Mercedes-Benz of the ministers and bought one of the cheapest car that would be the cars for his ministers, the Renault 5. He refused, as president, to use air conditioning because he said that is a luxury that is only available to a few of us. When he was asked, why don't you have your picture in a way in government buildings and ministries and shops everywhere like many presidents do, he said, why? I am just one Sankara. There are 7 million Thomas Sankaras. Very kind of symbolic, but in a way really getting to what Sankara was about. For behind all these reforms, what Sankara sought and wanted was a new identity for his people, was a new heart, if you like, for a new story in which Upper Volta could function as a new society. And so to signify this objective, this goal, on the fourth anniversary of his revolution that brought him to power, he renamed the country. Country that had been known as Upper Volta, he renamed it Burkina Faso, a name which means the country of the upright. A kind of heart transplant. But of course, like the story that we have witnessed in so many cases, as Sankara's reforms became popular, especially among the youth and the peasants, they alienated a small but very powerful middle class of the local elite and the foreign institutions like IMF and World Bank and the French government, whose interests were being threatened. So on October 15th, 1988, 5 years after he came to power, Sankara was assassinated by Blaise Compaoré, the same man who had helped to bring him to power. You know, it is not clear how far Sankara's revolution would have gone if he had not been assassinated. That is where, especially in this book, I make the argument that there were a number of limitations and shortcomings in Sankara that really hamstrung the revolution from the very start. That even though Sankara, for example, called his countrymen and women into a new future, into a new identity, he didn't seem to have a thick enough story in which to ground this new identity. Over and over again in his speeches, he would call upon the need for self-determination, the need for happiness, a new Upper Volta, Burkina Faso people who are the masters of their own destiny. So destiny, happiness, self-determination became very constant points of reference in his speech, pointing to the new Burkina society or people. But I argue that even though he made reference to these elements, happiness, self-determination, these elements themselves are in a way in search of a thick story in which to ground them. What is self-determination? What is happiness? Unless you lay it out in a thick account and through a thick story, it remains hopelessly vague. And I think perhaps that is one reason why, even though the majority of the people in Burkina Faso, especially the youth and the peasants, were taken up by Sankara's revolution, and indeed carried out massive demonstrations after he was assassinated, and the revolutions and demonstrations actually spread across Africa. I remember participating in one of those revolutions in Kampala, one of those demonstrations, carrying signs, who killed Thomas Sankara? Those who killed Thomas Sankara to be brought to trial. Soon, especially in the face of government repression in Burkina Faso, the demonstrations died down. And eventually, the revolution completely faded out. I think it would take us too much afield to really analyze Thomas Sankara's revolution now. But there are a couple of elements that I want to highlight for that really constitute part of this task of daring to invent the future. One, Sankara's clarity about the issue. The issue is not so much adjustments up here. The issue has to do with the foundation. Two, the need and urgency to reinvent the foundation, to reimagine, to revision, to rewire Africa within a new foundation. Three, Sankara's own leadership, Sankara's own style, and the success, astounding success during those 5 years of the revolution, in a way give us a glimpse of the possibilities of the project. And four, Sankara is indeed right. You cannot carry out this project without a certain degree of madness. The madness to think outside. The madness to think outside the usual parameters, the usual paradigm, in order to focus on what needs to be attended to, the very foundations of Africa's modernity. Wonderful, beautiful elements. What Sankara needed, lacked, and you could see in a number of speeches that he's kind of trying to get to, but what he needed and lacked was a thick narrative framework, a thick and a truthful story in which to ground this project. A good narrative framework that could, for example, capture a sense of, in the beginning, how are human societies imagined? That could also indicate certain plots along the way of that story, but also that could cast out a kind of eschatology, a kind of in the end, a kind of telos. Toward what? That is what Sankara so desperately needed but lacked. But the more you think about it, whether it is in terms of that thick story, or whether in terms of vision, revolutionary madness, courage, sacrifice, thinking clearly, all the elements in a way that Sankara identified as germane to the task of daring to invent the future, then one begins to see that these elements are not strange to Christian theology, that these elements are not strange to Christian praxis. In fact, when you think about, since an account of creation and eschatology, the end, is always, in a way, what is at stake in any Christian social vision, then Christian social ethics can provide a very fruitful, promising, and rich platform from which to engage the task of daring to invent the future. That it can do so, and that it has such powerful potential, is what is at stake in a story like that of Bishop Paris de Tabarne in the Sudan. So in this final section, let me just share briefly about Bishop Paris de Tabarne of the Sudan. So we move from West Africa, Burkina Faso, into the middle of Africa, the Sudan, the biggest country in Africa, almost the size of one-third of the U.S. In 2005, the Catholic Bishop, Paris de Tabarne, retired from his bishopric of Torit and moved to the remote area of Kron in Eastern Equatorial Province. And there, he founded a village settlement, and he called it the Holy Trinity Peace Village. Imagine the bishop retiring from Torit, the city, moving into the countryside, the remotest area in the Sudan, and founding a village settlement, Holy Spirit, Holy Trinity Peace Village. You know, for Saban, doing so was his response to Sudan's ongoing history of civil war, poverty, and tribalism. And Taban's own life had been so much caught up in these realities, just like the lives of many Sudanese. Taban was 19 when Sudan gained the independence from Egypt and England in 1955. That very same year, civil war broke out between the North and South, lasted for 17 years. In 83, the year Taban was appointed Bishop of Torit, another civil war broke out, this time in response to President Gaddafi Nimeri, who decided to make Sudan operate under Islamic law. Now, this second war, as it is called in the Sudan, lasted for over 20 years until very recently when a comprehensive peace agreement was signed in January 2005. But it devastated the entire social, health, education and political infrastructure of southern Sudan. The bombings during the war displaced an estimated 4 million people out of the population of 32 million and killed an estimated 2 million people. It damaged all the agricultural livelihood, the population, that led to food shortages and famine. Now, during this time of war, Taban proved himself to be a real pastor to the people of southern Sudan. You know, having himself been displaced by the fighting from his own diocese, he found himself homeless among other homeless people, feeding the hungry, organizing medical and food supplies, comforting the wounded and dying, and giving courage to those frightened and running away. And he traveled around the world as part of the advocacy, an advocacy campaign really calling for the end to civil war, founding the New Sudan Council of Churches that brings together all the Christian churches in the Sudan. And finally, partly because of the advocacy that he and others did, really leading to this comprehensive peace agreement of 2005. You know, even as his leadership during the war and advocacy was very, very much impressive, what is even more impressive is that when the war ended, after the signing of the peace agreement, when Taban had almost been identified as the one who was going to play a key role in the new Sudan government, that's when Taban decided to resign as bishop and retire to the most remote area and founded the Holy Trinity Peace Village. Holy Trinity Peace Village. A number of elements. Let me just quickly identify five elements about the Holy Trinity Peace Village. And you can, in a way, when you get a chance, look it up. www.clonevillage.net. It's an amazing experiment. Five elements. First of all, an interruption. Interruption. A holistic interruption. I lost my watch. Talk about interruption. Oh, okay. Let me wind up. An interruption. A holistic interruption. Food crops. People of different tribes, Muslims, Christian traditions, living together in this cooperative arrangement. And Taban calls it an oasis. An oasis, an interruption within a history of war, of famine, of tribalism. Interruption. Two, experiment in nation building. For this is what Taban hopes to see throughout the Sudan. That even though Kolon is a very small, in the middle of nowhere, It is, according to Taban, a very ambitious project. You cannot do it at once, stopping war, tribalism, violence, but you can only do it in a small way. That's what Taban is all about. And therefore, he calls this peace village a flame. In fact, the logo of the peace village is a flame. He also calls it a demonstration plot. Three, it is in a village. Very, very significant. Far away from the capital of Juba now, the new Sudan. That it is in a village for Taban is a counter-modernity. That in Africa, the villages are what to be run away from. They represent in a way the darkest forces of savagery as Africa was imagined. But that Taban would do the opposite move into the village was to signal that a new future in Africa would have to be founded within a complete logic and a different paradigm than neocolonial Africa. Four, and most important, that it is thoroughly theological. Holy Trinity Peace Village. This is the key inspiration behind the Peace Village. And therefore, the logo of the Peace Village is, in fact, three logs, three flames, three logs with a flame coming out of the three logs, in a way symbolizing the harmonious love of the three persons of the Trinity. And finally, President Omar Bashir of Sudan recently described Taban as the mad bishop. And it's not difficult to see why he called him a mad bishop. For who but a mad bishop would retire, resign his see in the city, move into the village, the most remote village, and from there imagine that he can, in a way, do an experiment that would lead to a total end of tribalism, war, and poverty. And in a way, Taban shares the same revolutionary madness as Thomas Sankara. But unlike Thomas Sankara, the difference between Thomas Sankara and Taban is not just a strategic difference. It is fundamentally theological. For Sankara wanted a revolution that everything would happen at once. But Taban is okay. He's at home with living with small experiments, starting in a smaller way. But to the extent that it is the vision of the Trinity in itself that depicts in a way and frames this whole village, it is in a way the story that Taban has been living into as a bishop. And what he's trying to do is to work out the social and practical implications of what this means in terms of the relationships, of the harmonious relationships, in terms of the abundance in a way that he describes as the food abundance, as an expression of that abundance of the life of the Holy Trinity that flows into one another, but also in terms of the incarnation of the second person of the Trinity living within a village in a way is part of that incarnation. So that's why Taban is able to relocate in a way to a remote village, because he is thinking about another revolutionary madman, the second person of the Trinity, who, in a way, came to dwell among us and pitched his tent in Galilee and other backwaters, and from there, in a way, inflame a revolution that would come to characterize and be the source of hope for all hitherto marginalized or abused by the system. So, my dear friends, you ask me, what keeps me hopeful about Africa in the face of the stories of the likes of Gabo and Obiang? It is stories like that of Taban. No doubt, Obiang, Gabo are madmen operating within the drama of modern Africa. What makes me hopeful, and I would be without any hope at all if we didn't have stories of other madmen who operate out of a different type of madness, a madness that pushes them to dare to invent the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Father Emma, Dr. Katagwe, for that riveting lecture with story, with theory, with theology. We have a lot to talk about here. I would ask those of you who have a question, please come up to the microphone, or if you'd like, we can bring the microphone to you. We have about 20 minutes for a conversation, and I look forward to your contribution.
Many thanks. I have a rather convoluted question, but I'll try and make it as clear as I can. I'm thinking of a bifurcation here. On one side, there is the Treaty of Westphalia that brought the concept of sovereignty and nationhood to the Europeans. And yet, 200 years later, the Berlin Conference gave them the same opportunity to extend sovereignty and nationhood to Africa as a continent. Rather, they carved it up and expropriated it. From your talk, we hear that Africans themselves appropriated that expropriation, so to speak, and created another kind of madness, so to speak. I wonder if you skipped over the madness of patricide. Let me broaden it, parricide, and the symbolic and derivative versions of that. In Ghana, for example, when the young non-commissioned officers began to take over one after another, the tendency was to sacrifice anyone who was on the verge of doing something positive. And Rawlins was the quintessential example of that. Someone who literally went all the way to Europe to look for his Scottish father, who refused to see him. He goes back to Ghana after the father's refusal to see him to literally decapitate all existing former heads of state. A series of decapitations continue. Judges were killed, Catholic priests were killed, and on and on and on, until eventually the country said, "We are tired of this outrage." Out of this outrage came a return to custom, which is regard for one another. In a sense, a return to the autochthony of self-respect and, if you like, a deeper kind of reverence, which returned us back to democracy, which is now being continued. So I wonder if the narrative of patricide, which happened to Sankara, for example, could be elaborated on.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for that. Let me briefly say a couple of things about that. I think what you say is exactly true about patricide. And when you see it in the ongoing reality within Africa, actually it's not only in terms of killing the elite. And it is, I think, part of the wider story of the sacrifice. Within the modern drama that I'm trying to narrate, written within that is the idea of sacrifice in terms of who gets sacrificed in view of advancing at the performance of this modern rationality. That, I think, is deeply connected with a struggle for power, with plunder, with serving a very limited elite. So, and the sacrifice, in a way, begins with the sacrifice of the innocent. But eventually, those who live by the sacrifice also eventually get caught up and they will die by the same violence. So then it becomes an ongoing cycle of violence and sacrifice or patricide.
So how do we move on from there? I'm not sure I quite agree with you that to return to custom provide a far, by custom, I get traditional custom, provides a story that would save us from sacrifice. For example, when you look at the story, for example, like many of us know the story of things fall apart, or Okonkwo's story and things fall apart. Traditional society itself is in a way caught up within endless sacrifice, whether we are the weak and the women are, and the twins and everybody is sacrificed. So I don't get so much consolation as just a return to custom. That's why I don't find the argument appealing and say, well, Africa would have been better off if colonialism, if Europeans had not stepped at their feet in Africa. Africa would have developed within a different trajectory, no doubt about that. I don't know whether better off or not, I'm not sure. Traditional society in itself is also grounded within a particular story that needs to be read. And the more you read that, the more you see that it is, in a way, also built on patricide, on the sacrifice of the weak and the innocent. So I'm not calling just a return to, or if Africa could return to its African roots. I wish things were that simple. What I'm calling is for a truthful story to ground the new project of daring to invent Africa beyond colonialism, beyond nativism. I don't think nativism is as salvific as we at times think right now.
By custom, I meant ethos.
Ah. Ethos, yes. Good. Then we are quite together. Thank you.
Thank you. I very much enjoyed your talk. I'd love to hear your comments on some of the history of the church's involvement in Africa. And I can talk a little bit from my own experience in South Africa of seeing almost centuries of European churches involved in small villages, like you describe, mission stations. And Nelson Mandela was educated at one of these haven-like mission stations, where as a barefoot child, he received a wonderful education and went on to great things. But I'd love to hear your comments about the kind of daring that you're talking about going forward compared to many Swedish, French, Catholic, Lutheran, Presbyterian, you know, many different churches have been involved in Africa's past and have done some great things, but trying to maintain that momentum, build a foundation, as you talk about, that is going to stand for many years, is a difficult thing. Mm-hmm. So I'd love to hear your comments on that.
Well, again, I'm just thinking aloud, given what you just mentioned about the performance of the church in different places. I think the way churches have lived and positioned themselves in Africa is mostly... Yeah, it's an ambiguous presence. So it's not just the fact that, oh, if only we had churches, if only we had more churches, things would be okay. Because many times also Christianity got wedded very closely together with this narrative that, in a way, sacrifices Africa, sacrifices the village, sacrifices the weak, and so forth. And so kind of positioned has set of Christianity usually within that dominant narrative in a way that benefits the limited elite. So it's not only a question of going back to Christianity. Christianity also has to rethink its presence within the social history of Africa and in fact ground whatever theological and practical presence within that project of reinventing a new future in Africa that is grounded within the narrative, the basic narrative of Scripture, that is one, not simply a spiritual thing. That's one one area in which the Christianity has to reinvent itself. Christianity's presence in Africa is not to carry out a spiritual mission. It's not to save Africans to go to the afterlife. There are some churches that locate themselves within very neatly a very narrow spiritual realm, and they say, oh, we are not involved in all the other stuff and so forth and so on. That's already in a way to surrender or to operate within this house, whose foundation actually needs to be rethought. It's kind of refusing really to get into the very foundation. So how to rethink that? I think Christianity is the pressing challenge to Christianity now is how to rethink the message and the presence of Christianity on the African soil. But also it might involve, and I think this is also quite important, it might involve laying aside some of the traditional denominational baggage that in a way characterize the churches in the West, that at times is transported into Africa, and that we in Africa at times find ourselves fighting battles about which we don't know the beginning or the end. Yes, in my own country, Uganda, it was the French missionaries that in a way brought Catholicism, and the English missionaries brought Anglicanism. And just 10 years of Christianity's presence in Africa, we found ourselves in a religious war in Africa, in Uganda, Catholics fighting Protestants. Only now I realize that actually it was the French fighting the English in Uganda. And so some of, in a way, part of Christianity's challenge is how to redefine herself in relation to this very urgent project of really reinventing Africa, of really grafting Africa within a story that promises that new future. So within the practices of everyday life. But it is definitely an ongoing project.
I think there are two possible knee-jerk perspectives. One is to say that imperialists have brought all good to Africa and haven't been well received. The other one is to say everything that imperialists, including Christian-motivated imperialists, have touched has turned bad. And neither one of those is very helpful, because I think there's probably, I wonder if you agree, still a role for outside people of faith to come alongside Africans and try to be part of the solution, just as much as there's a need for Africans to rise up and exert their own leadership.
Hmm.
So there's a mutuality that's called for which there are not many great precedents. What do you see as some of the most hopeful examples of mutuality within Christian circles today?
Hmm. Well, first of all, I hope my lecture did not sound like saying all the problems in Africa because have been brought from outside. I hope my lecture did not sound like that. I'm just trying to really look at the modern institutions in Africa and economics, politics, education, all the other institutions that were founded within modernity. And those cannot be understood, and the performance of Africa today cannot be understood without that historical connection with a European project in Africa. And I think that needs to be theorized more and more. Let's not shy away from it because out of politeness or trying to say, well, again, the people will say, there you go again, there you blame everything on the colonialists and so forth. We are very colonial in Africa. You cannot understand Africa today, modern Africa today, without connecting those dots. Colonialism stroke modernity has worked extremely very well in Africa. Our imaginations, we as Africans, our thinking and so forth, has been completely directed into a modern direction. So it has been a very powerful influence that needs to be thought through. And without thinking that it is a quick game of blaming, that's why I also resist the temptation that, oh, if only we could go back to. No, This is what we have now. How do we think through in terms of providing a new foundation? And part of the new foundation means that we're not living in an isolated world. West and Africa is much, much, much more connected. So anyway, more hopeful are ways in which West and Africa in a way collaborate. One, first of all, collaborate in view of what? It has to be in view of what I feel is the most urgent task right now, or daring to invent the future in Africa. The challenge with most of Western programs in Africa, they come many times already so fully packaged as solutions, and with the solutions and problems that have been already thought through, and all is waiting is implementation or delivery. And Christianity also can play very well into that kind of delivery, that mode, that we have the answers, let's just go help Africa, let's just go save Africans and so forth. I think the most hopeful engagements between with the West and Africa that I've seen involve really journeys, long-term journeys, not this kind of short-term missions that go to save Africa, but long-term mission journeys and collaborations where Christians from the West have taken time even to understand what is going on in Africa, and perhaps lived there long enough to begin to feel the issues on the ground. And there are a number of initiatives that are already like that. But also other initiatives is when, for example, you see all the people that go to Bishop Taban's Peace Village and they want to help in one way or another. One thing that Taban insists, one, is that first of all, it can't be short term. You can't come and say, oh, we have this project, it's going to be for a year. That can't work. You need to connect and commit for longer. I think what I'm pushing for more and more is a kind of incarnational presence that stays a long time. And I have some more other stories where there is a lot of collaboration between some Western missionaries, churches, and so forth, and African stories. For example, the story of Maison Shalom in Burundi. But much of it, in a way, is sitting at the feet of Africa, learning in Africa, within Africa, and many times, in a way, giving up part of the power that comes with the solutions and very well packaged solutions at that.
I would like to thank you again for your visit. Hopefully this is the first of many conversations on Africa and politics and the whole important task of thinking about a different narrative, a counter-narrative. So thank you for the gift of your presence. I'd like to make a couple of quick announcements. Tomorrow morning, we'll have a time of sort of informal Q&A with Dr. Katagale at our home, the Marsh home, which is sometimes called the Bonhoeffer House on University Circle. We'll have coffee and pastries from 10 o'clock until noon. Anyone is invited to come for the whole time or for 5 minutes or 10 minutes, and we can open up the book, other books, and we will have a great time. And Karen Wright Marsh is waving to me little flyers that you can take with you as you go about this. Also, we have copies of Emmanuel's book available in the Splintered Light bookstore over on the corner. And then finally, I would like to make one announcement that among this distinguished audience today, we do welcome Deans Meredith Wu and Robert Faton, and Dr. Apre, all of who have made a profound commitment to intellectual formation and growth within a diverse and global perspective in a way that has greatly enriched the mission of educating men and women for our responsible citizenship. And we are grateful to you for inspiring, you know, the academical village towards a new and, I think, very exciting internationalism. So thanks for your presence today. Thanks to all of you for being here this evening. Take care. We'll see you later.